Thank you so much, Richard, for the wonderful meeting. Now we have time for questions, especially some of our medical students or nursing students or anybody else in the audience.
Yeah.
With pain.
Thank you.
Hi. First of all, thank you for coming. It was a really interesting speech. And then I have a question. We saw the differences between the different countries with inequality. But what do you think that in time, in our history, had changed something like in the final states? We saw that there's some years that something could happen to change that kind of equality that there were and there now is not. What do you think that could happen? I mean, a war or a crisis, economical crisis or something? What do you think? Thank you.
You mean what would happen if inequality went on rising? There is some research that suggests that civil disorder, assassinations, coups and things like that are more common where there is greater inequality, but it's not very strong evidence. But I think that society has become dysfunctional. You can't, and if you don't spend on redistribution, on education, on health services, you find yourself spending on prisons instead, on the what do they call it, the defensive labor. You need more prisons and police, and in some American states they spend more on prisons than on higher education. I think that we also have to think about this in relation to climate change. I think there's no doubt at all, I could go into it in more detail if you want, that more equal societies will find it easier to adapt in a way they're more, well, not only more cohesive, but more flexible. They're better at adapting to whatever comes their way than more unequal societies. And the whole political process in the United States particularly has been seriously damaged by inequality and by the power of money in politics. So I think everyone would be very worried about where the United States is going if it doesn't reverse the trends.
Yeah, my question is about this, the last thing you talk about, is how can we reverse this trend? You show us what's the trend. But how can we reverse the trend? And more specifically, for instance, we as a physicians or nurses, in a primary care physician, how can in an everyday practices try to reverse this tendency?
The last part of your question first. I think that you as the experts on health must make it clear that what you can do is just pick up the pieces. You can work to try and offset the damage that people are suffering in society, whether it's a result of the fast food industry or deprivation or whatever, that the causes of health and illness are intensely political, and can't be dealt with by medical care alone. And I think, you know, if you live in a, if you work in a poor area, your workload is likely to be bigger if people are properly, have proper medical care coverage, than if you live in a rich area. In Britain, our, I don't know about here, our health service, primary care physicians get more money if they work in a poor area. There's a system for weighting things according to measures of health and deprivation. In terms of how we change it, there are two ways, I think, of dealing with income differences. And by the way, I would use figures on wealth differences if they were, if comparable data was available for more countries. It's very difficult to make good comparisons of wealth differences. That's why we just use income, but ideally I'd put the two together. You can either redistribute. In Sweden starts off with very big differences in earnings, in market incomes before tax. And it has high taxes and generous welfare spending, so it closes the gap substantially. Yet there are other countries, like Japan, that start off with smaller differences in market incomes and do less redistribution. I think we have to pursue policies to redistribute and to reduce the inequalities in market incomes before tax. The problem with relying just on taxes and benefits is that any new government that comes in that doesn't like these this redistribution can undo it so easily. And I think many people regard taxation as sort of legalized theft. You know, this is my money and the government is taking it away from me. Big bad government is, you know, how so many people see it, especially in the United States. I must say I was delighted at a trade union conference in Norway where one of the women trade union leaders started off by saying, "We trust our government." Such a different relationship in more equal countries. But I think to reduce the income differences before tax, basically organized labor, trade union strength, social democratic parties and so on were important, but I think we've lost a lot of that. I think that now many of the heavy industries have gone, it'll be harder to recreate the trade union strength that we had. But I think you can move towards forms of economic democracy. About half the countries, members of the European Union, have some legislation for employee representatives on company boards. And in Germany, I think when a company has as many as 2,000 employees, half the representatives deciding pay have to be employee representatives. I think we need, every country should have that legislation. In Britain, we have nothing like that. I think we should actually, radical parties should have an aim of democratizing the economy. The evidence is now good that employee-owned companies, more democratic companies, cooperatives actually work better, higher productivity, and they change the experience of work. People say that an employee buyout of a company can turn a company from being simply a piece of property into a community. So I feel the next big step in human emancipation, the long-term aim must be the democratization of the economy through all those different forms. But in terms of increasing taxes and benefits, that has been very difficult over the recent decades because the rich can hide their money so easily in tax havens. So if you do raise top tax rates, you don't get nearly as much money as you expect, because that just gives more incentive to find ways of hiding your money. But OECD has now got agreement from most of the tax havens to share data with the tax authorities in different countries. But for some reason, it's not going to come into force until next year. They made that agreement in the middle of last year. Why it couldn't be, I mean, it looks rather as if they're allowing people time to hide their money somewhere else. But it's a necessary precondition for raising top tax rates.
A short comment on the taxation that I read in the New York Times recently, an article that spoke about the tax inspectors in the United States being unable to understand the mechanisms by which some of the richest were able to hide. So meaning, very, very bluntly, that they were hiring, these rich fortunes were hiring the best students that were coming out of the best universities, thinking how to scheme that process so that the US inspectors, the official ones, could not understand actually the complexity of that and could not then prosecute them.
I think the bank managers didn't understand what the subordinates, these instruments were
exactly.
So complicated.
Exactly, really it was very interesting. But my question was too actually, you mentioned it very briefly, but I would be interested in knowing whether some of the indexes that you've talked about actually have a gender change. So whether the gender affects spontaneously, I would think that on this link so strong and so clear between happiness and then social status, that maybe for the man and the woman would be a bit different, but I don't know whether there is research on that, and that affects the health outcomes. And then also my other question would be whether there is research about religion, religiosity or religious belief as something that can help leave this social inequality as not so directly impinging on your self-esteem.
The gender differences exist, certainly. And first I should say that the gender differences, the women's disadvantage in terms of access to top positions or their political participation or proportion of women in parliaments at local government level and national, and women's pay disadvantage, all tends to be greater in more unequal societies. Japan is the exception. You know, in the more equal Scandinavian countries, women's participation and pay disadvantage is much smaller than in the more unequal countries. But Japan, many fewer women are economically active. There are different, I think the evolved psychology means there are different gender responses to inequality. So, you know, young men coming onto the labour market, finding there's a high unemployment and very low pay, that feeds directly into male violence. In women, it's more likely to feed into teenage birth rates. They're both very closely related to deprivation. So I think there are different male and female responses. In obesity, we found that women's obesity is more closely correlated to inequality than men's obesity. I suspect partly because women's obesity is more closely related to social status. So there are different responses, but it's not always that men are more strongly affected. Sometimes they're just different responses. I should say that the teenage birth rate thing, I mean, the suggestions that there are different reproductive strategies. If you're in a very insecure environment, you do better if you have lots of children. You start having children very early. If you're going to lose some, then maybe you'll have some left if you've had lots. But if you're in a very secure environment, you will put much more investment into a small number. And I think even with the age at which women reach sexual maturity, if they're stressed, they reach sexual maturity earlier, at least in modern societies.
Hello.
I think you really have to understand these in terms of our evolved responses to dominance hierarchy. Sorry, there was a...
Well, hello. I have two questions. One of them is, if I am born poor and I grow up poor, but then I become rich, do my children will have the effect of inequality that I had? And the other question is, if do we have enough resources to guarantee equality around the world? Because we are facing a climate change and we are living in just one planet.
I didn't hear the last part of that. Around the world, do you mean, are these effects, do they exist in poorer countries?
No, we have like enough resources to guarantee?
Enough resources.
Hmm. Well, if you've seen the figures on world inequality in wealth, and I think something like, you can fit the richest 62 people in the world into a bus, and they own as much wealth as something like the poorest half of the world. It might be the poorest third of the world. So, you know, there's enormous potential, and we are wasting resources. You know, in that early graph, I might use that as well. That's so many slides back. If you draw this graph, not for GDP per capita and life expectancy, but if you put carbon emissions per capita along the bottom, it's still almost exactly the same shape. And so what it's telling us is that actually we're consuming vastly more than we need to gain high levels of life expectancy, and vastly more than we need, emitting vastly more carbon than we need to gain high levels of life expectancy, and as I said earlier when I was showing you this, to gain high levels of happiness. So the rich world is consuming resources, it's wasting resources, I think, on status competition, consumerism and so on, which is, status competition is a zero-sum game. I can improve my status in relation to yours, but we can't all improve our average status in relation to each other. So at a societal level, status competition is a zero-sum game. So the rich world is wasting resources that the poorer part of the world desperately needs. You know, if you draw, and I have a graph somewhere for the average carbon emissions per head of population, and it comes somewhere here, and actually the whole world could be, on existing technology, achieving high levels of life expectancy without increasing carbon emissions, but actually with more efficient energy-saving technology, we can do a lot better than that. So I do think there are enough resources for everyone, though I think population growth makes these problems more serious. And one of the best ways of reducing population growth is to raise living standards in the poorest countries. Your question about whether your children will inherit your family origins, I think there are some long-term effects, but most important is the quality of family relationships. How some of this stuff gets into children's lives is through the quality of family relationships. Good relationships are highly protective. And it looks as if it's the quality of relationships which triggers the epigenetic responses. You know, if you as a child experience a lot of domestic conflict, or if your parents are depressed and don't have time for you, then you're less social than if you're used to that eye contact, attention, interaction all the time. There's actually a paper which shows there's more child abuse in American states that are more unequal. So we think family life is more stressful in more unequal societies. And that actually is one of the findings that comes from those studies of child well-being that I showed you data from. Sorry.
Hello.
Hello.
Do you think it is possible for us to see long-lasting changes in social inequalities under a neoliberalistic system or under any kind of capitalist system, for that matter?
Can you repeat the last part? It's my hearing. I have hearing aids.
I said, do you think if we can see long-lasting changes in social inequalities under a neoliberalistic system or under any other kind of capitalist system?
I think we can't do without a great deal of market allocation of resources. But I think we must have powerful forces conditioning the market. I think the most worrying problem is the manipulative power of multinational corporations. Any new bit of health research, public health research that comes out, the first people who come and suggest that the research is wrong, is rubbish, are people from the industry defending their profits. That happened with tobacco, it happens with climate change, and we had the recent issue of the Volkswagen diesel cars. I'm sure other companies are guilty of the same kind of behavior, but that's killed tens of thousands of people, that fraudulent behavior, and we must be able to sue those companies. Maybe even hold the directors personally liable. But I think part of the response should be democratizing these companies. And where they make quite different goods, where there isn't an advantage in having them part of the same organization, they should be split up. They're really systems for concentrating power and money at the top. I did skip over a graph. This is going to be too slow to go through it. I'll show it sometime. That one. This is
income differences. Where's the microphone? Sorry.
This is income differences in the 350 biggest American corporations. And what the graph shows from 1965 to 2010 is the pay difference between the CEO at the top and the average production worker. And you see, this is 1975, that's 1980, and they were getting, 30 times as much. The CEOs at the top were getting 30 times the average production worker. This is 1995, 2000, 2005. They're getting 200 or 300 times as much. And that is really this disease has spread with neoliberal ideology from one country to another. it was trade union strength and the force of the labour movement, I think the threat of communism, that kept the differences smaller in the past. But I think now we must stop this happening through forms of democratisation. And they are good for the businesses as well as good for income distribution.
Hi, Richard. Well, first of all, I would like to thank you for not only for your presentation, but also for your academic career and not only your papers and books, but also the power to disseminate.
It was a very comfortable academic career.
Yeah. Well, but of this, you know, the power to disseminate, there is no common, you know, to find a bestseller that is disseminated and not only in the public health environment, but in other environments. So my first question is kind of general, is what is your assessment after all these years, you know, presenting your findings, your book, etc. What has been your assessment, the pros and cons in different environments, academic environments, unions, social movements, etc. What are the positive or the not so positive message that we can learn? And because I always thought that it's crucial to, you know, to spread the word and disseminate, you know, such a crucial issue for our times, inequality. The second question is perhaps more academic. You know, you basically in your studies have disseminated many of the findings and the evidence on psychosocial issues. And that goes back to a very old discussion and debate in the academia and the papers, talking about, you know, the material versus the psychosocial factors affecting health and health inequalities. I wonder, just at the very end of your presentation, you mentioned the unions, and now in some of your responses, the corporations and, you know, the economic democracy. I certainly fully agree. But I think also that there is enough evidence to suggest that aside from the psychosocial factors, that there are factors like, I don't know, in Spain, clearly housing addictions, precarious employment, many other factors that goes together.
Yeah.
And interrelate and are intertwined with the psychosocial one. So my academic question would be, what do you think about, you know, the need, I guess, to integrate some of the whole picture, just something like to get the whole picture of putting together, you know, the power corporations, the policies and politics and so on, just to understand what's going on and, of course, try to change it.
On the second point, I think that the material effects of inequality, they're particularly important in developing countries, in poorer developing countries. I think they're better understood. The newspapers will say quite clearly about the effects of this and this Volkswagen business on air pollution. People, and it's easier to understand, and the naive view of inequality only recognizes those direct material effects. They're obviously important, and I think with bigger inequality, they become more important. We now have food banks in Britain that very large numbers of people are using. But I think it's important to make the case for relating to the well-being of the vast majority of the population. And actually, I can live in a society with awful air pollution and still be quite happy. If I'm full of self-doubts and find social contact very strenuous and difficult, that has a much more fundamental impact on the quality of life that matters to me. So I emphasize the psychosocial things partly because I think the material is better understood, but partly because I think that this matters to the well-being of the majority of the population more, the psychosocial stuff, and is less well understood. Your other question, I think, was really about the impact of doing this kind of work. Well, there's obviously been an enormous change in attitudes to inequality. I think largely as a result of the financial crash. And the way I see it is that, you know, the political pendulum was fairly far over to the left up until sometime in the 1970s, and then it began to move to the right, and moved to the right continuously until the financial crash. That was an international trend. I mean, it caught hold of countries at different points of time. So the English-speaking countries became dominated by neoliberal ideology sooner than other countries. I think other countries were protected by having a different language. They watched each other's television a little bit less, read each other's newspapers less, things like that. But actually these trends in ideology have always been international. I mean, if you think of the 1848 revolutions, they happen in lots of different countries and even in different continents. And the 1960s was a radical decade everywhere. I think that since the financial crash, the pendulum has it stopped moving to the right and has just begun to move to the left and maybe gathering pace. So I suspect we may have the benefit of a radical period in front of us, at least a less conservative period in front of us. Although there are some obvious obstacles to that, I think that having to deal with climate change actually favours more progressive left politics. I don't think and the carbon footprints of the rich are just so much bigger. And you see, and even if you look at this historically, when in the 18th century, up to the 18th century, society's resources for food and clothing were regarded as limited. So conspicuous consumption, excessive consumption, was regarded as not quite moral. That changed with Mandeville, his fable of the bees, and with Adam Smith, where suddenly, if I consume a lot, then I'm giving all you people jobs. And the idea that resources were unlimited, they could be expanded, limitless. We now know that there are environmental limitations, which I think may again fit an ideology about sharing more fairly. And I'm sure to move towards sustainability, we have to do that. But there has been a huge change in media attention to inequality. And it was helped enormously by the Occupy movement. But now Obama said it's the defining issue of our era. The Pope has made similar pronouncements. Ban Ki-moon at the UN, Christine Lagarde at IMF. They've all made these statements. We haven't had much change, except in some of the southern European countries have elected left-wing governments, and signs of that, of course, in the support for Sanders in the States, you know, a democratic socialist getting widespread support in the States. I don't think he'll become president, but it's a sign of a groundswell of opinion. And in Britain, the election of Jeremy Corbyn as Labour leader, I think he'll probably lose the next election. But we've begun to build a more radical movement. And that movement support comes from younger people. They will become a larger proportion of the population as they grow older. The support for Trump and the right tends to be older people. So I think there are grounds for optimism.
Do you agree saying that one of the best ways to reduce inequality is to increase or to increase education, to increase, I mean, to increase the educational budget of the nations.
Education, did you
education,
say?
Education would be one of the best ways to reduce inequality in the nations.
I think educational systems affect inequality. I think sometimes they reinforce it. You know, in Britain we have private schools which give people a huge advantage in going to better universities. Educational systems can do the opposite. They, instead of reinforcing inequality, they can reduce it. But I think it's really important to remember that the big increases in inequality since 1980, the increases in inequality since 1980 were not changes in educational systems. It was a change in economic ideology. And it went with privatization of companies. It went with lowering top tax rates. One of the interesting effects of lowering top tax rates, you'd have thought if you were rich people and I lowered your tax rates, you would all be happier with what you've got. You'd have more of your income left over. But actually, OECD has shown that the much more important, more powerful effect is that if you're having 80 or 90% of your income taken away from you, as happened in the United States and Britain in the 1960s and 70s, there's not very much point in trying to get more money out of your company. But as soon as you can keep most of it, it's worth fighting for more. Talking to your fellow directors and say, you know, we put a lot of work into this and we have rather rare talents, I think. We should all pay each other more. So what you see is the countries which lowered top tax rates most had the biggest increases in pre-tax top incomes. Quite a strong relationship. So actually, increasing top tax rates may be a way of reducing income differences before tax. So education can do something, but it wasn't the cause of this problem.
I have one more question.
Hi, I'm Gabriela. I'm a public health specialist, and I born and I grew up in Argentina, and I moved here 11 years ago. So I experienced some of the things that you were discussing about unequal and insecure countries. And now, when I'm living here, I feel more secure, even though we are just in the middle, or we are just not as equal as we would like to be. So my question is, and I like you to present things about children as very the very sensitive part of these unequal countries and the part of these inequalities in health. Because I'm now involved in organizing a workshop in inequalities in children, now here in June in Barcelona. I don't know if it sounds familiar to you, this workshop. And so I would like you to have a word about policies to protect children from inequalities.
Yes, and I think one of the most commonly emphasized measures in public health is to provide more support for small children and parents with young children. And you know the valuations of preschool provisions and maternity leave and paternity leave, which seem to show that there are really important benefits that these systems pay for themselves. And some of that work really, I suppose, comes from the research of David Barker, which showed that, for instance, birth weight is a risk factor for heart disease and stroke and so on when you get to my age. But it's not just birth weight, it's early childhood experience. And as I said in answer to another question, the quality of family relationships. I don't know whether people know exactly why family support has such benefits, and you might say that it gives that if creches and preschool nurseries and so on give parents a break. So perhaps when they're with their children, you know, relationships are better than if they're feeling imprisoned by their children. It may be something that they do in the nurseries that is so valuable. I don't think we know, though I haven't been reading all the research recently. In Britain, we've just had evaluations of an American system called the Family Nurse Partnership, where women are given more support in pregnancy by health visitors, and I think soon after the baby is born as well. And although it showed great benefits in the States, it doesn't show any benefit in Britain. And one of the most plausible explanations is that in the United States, if you're poor, you get almost nothing in pregnancy. In Britain, we have a system of health visitors and medical care and so on, so you get something. So the family nurse partnership doesn't make quite so much difference. And I think evaluations show usually that these systems make the biggest difference to the poorest families. I don't know that I can say.
It would be like strengthen the health system in this, I mean, strengthen the health system would be like...
Yes, but it's not just health. When I was talking about the epigenetics, you know, that sensitive period in early life exists not only amongst humans but amongst animals and so on. I mean, if you want to get a dog that'll be a nice animal to live with, you get one that's been treated very well early on when it was a puppy, and the same with a cat or anything else. But that early sensitive period is about, it enables the organism to develop to the kind of world it's dealing with. And if you grow up in a family where there is a lot of conflict, or as I said, depression or lacking of attention, you don't become as socialized. And to learn to be good at empathy and cooperation and so on, to function in a more egalitarian society, you need to be have that interaction, that eye-to-eye contact and so on, that handling. But it might be that these kids who have a very tough early childhood may function better in a very unequal dog-eat-dog society where everyone's out for themselves. I think we shouldn't think of them as just damaged. They're adapted to a different kind of world.
You have one more question here.
You talked about the importance of conscience, like of the importance that these academic data get out to the public so that they become conscious of the importance of equality. How would you do that? Because, for example, I grew up in the United States, and every morning we would say the Pledge of Allegiance or sing patriotic songs, where they talk, the main message is about equality. On the other hand, the United States on most of these graphics is the most unequal country, and moreover, New York State, which is where I grew up. So it's kind of contradictory, because the message that thousands of kids throughout the United States say every morning, or at least once a week, is for liberty and justice for all, which is how the Pledge of Allegiance ends. But it's the most unequal country.
Yes, I think it is you're pointing to a very real difficulty. But I do think that, you know, the support for Sanders shows that people are able to see through some of this, that they get some of this picture intuitively in some way, that there are people who are aware of the level of egotism, narcissism, status competition. And I remember some of my son's friends, they just regarded society as shit. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. They felt they could somehow ignore all this nasty world, dead scared of applying for jobs where you had to wear suits and go and be evaluated in an interview. You know, that was the sort of the way all that nasty world works, and we don't want that. But no developed political understanding. But I think that the importance of social media is growing. I think it helps people develop other ideologies. It means that the media controlled by the super rich is perhaps becoming less powerful than it was, as well as using our website in the Equality Trust. There are about 20 local groups around the country which meet up and discuss things and write to their members of parliament and newspapers. But we saw a play the other day that I think it's called the Swedish Council or something, had given money to a theatre company in Sweden to link up with one in Morocco, and they did a play that they said was inspired by our book. They did it in both Morocco and Sweden. I found it quite hard to see the relationship between the play and the book. There's also a film that's just been made called The Divide, which is coming out very soon. There are a great deal of video virals, short video explanations of the scale of inequality and what it means in the States. I think we have to use all these methods, but the internet and social media films. And the main thing is not just to leave your research in academic journals. When I first started getting interested in health inequalities in the 1970s, you could talk to senior people in our health services, and you'd say there are these huge class differences in death rates, you know. And they wouldn't know which way round they were. They didn't know whether death rates were highest at the top or the bottom. And now everyone takes it for granted that the death rates are worst at the bottom. And I think that change in public understanding has been a result of little bits of research from hundreds of people, each one being a little reason for a short newspaper story. So, you know, people know that poverty and unemployment damages health. It changes how we see poverty and unemployment. So I think that's the way we've got to do it. But it won't be done in 2 years. It'll be done in 10 or 15, something like that. It means a sustained social movement, political movement. But we must think about a new form of society which deals with inequality, which deals with sustainability, which raises the real quality of our lives. The quality of our lives is now dependent primarily on the quality of social relations, not in raising material standards. So actually, under sustainability, we can improve the real quality of our lives. It's not a nasty thing where we have to give up income, we have to tighten our belts, live these nasty lives with less of everything. We can actually have a better life and sustainability.
One more question, I think probably the last one, because we're getting late.
You talked about social media. I'm making a research about YouTube as a tool to make people autonomy healthcare, to make this way to make people a healthcare way. And when you look at YouTube videos, there are some videos that there are not made, but people with a scientific knowledge. And sometimes the popularity, the virality that you taught, it's more efficient to the videos that they are not, that they don't have scientific found, that the true videos, the videos that are made by healthcare providers. I mean, how do you think we as healthcare providers have to adapt our knowledge to make people trust us when we make a video in YouTube? Thank you.
Well, of course, surveys suggest that people trust politicians and journalists less than anyone else. Academics and doctors and people are, levels of trust are quite high. But I do think it means finding the right language. I think that actually some of the videos and films that have been made are very well informed, and that some of the makers are, have real expertise in taking scientific stuff and communicating it. So I've usually been quite impressed by what journalists have done with stories. And I think the Divide film that's coming out now, it's, in some ways it's a very good film in that it shows all the different effects of inequality on people's lives, rich and poor, but it doesn't say, and this problem that you've just seen is much more common in more unequal societies. So it makes it clear it's a film about inequality, and it shows more people in prison, and it shows people with terribly worried about status issues, but it doesn't quite go into the full explanations, so I'm a bit disappointed about that. But well, I'm, the communication of science is an art, and we must all learn to do it. I can't say very much more about your question. And I sometimes say to people, I was one of the most nervous speakers ever, and I slowly learned how to do it. Kate, my co-author, and I think we've done about 900 talks since our book came out, and you slowly learn to do it. You get a sense, and it really is worth. And I used to have a policy of saying yes to all invitations, although I hated public speaking because I found it so difficult. But you can train yourself to do it. And somehow you gradually find a way of saying something that you get a feeling from the audience, yeah, that's something that relates to their intuitions. And so that form of expression sticks in your mind. So you use it next time, and you slowly accumulate bits like that without consciously intending to. You just find neat ways of saying things. I used to have a friend who was a playwright on the fringe theatre, the tiny little theatres in pubs and so on in London. And I remember I would go laboriously through talking about bits of my research, and it would take me 15 minutes to explain what this research was saying. And he'd say, oh, you mean such and such. And he'd say the same thing in one half sentence, just one phrase. And he had a sort of intuition that was able to do that. I think it is a real skill, and some journalists are good at it.
Thank you for the very nice talk. I got inspired by my daughter's question because, well, I've seen what she said before, and one of the things that is very contradictory in the United States, but I think it's everywhere, is that the children receive this message about equality, but they are prompt to compete with each other all the time. So this, and we have the honor roll, whatever, valedictorian, I don't know how it's called in the UK. Here we have the matricula de honor that asks the children to compete with each other and to show that they are better than others. So, and I think I would like you to say a few words about this. At the bottom of all this is the idea of whether we accept that there are some people that is better than other, and they need to show it, because I think that's at the bottom of inequality.
One of the chapters where we have in the book we're just finishing writing now, it won't be published until 2017, I think the popular idea is the differences in ability. And people think of those as almost genetic differences in ability, and that leads to different positions in the social hierarchy. An idea that the social hierarchy is simply a reflection of differences in innate ability. But what we're saying, based on studies of the malleability of the human brain, particularly early on in life, is that the causality is mainly the other way. It goes from position in the social hierarchy to differences in ability. I remember a study of London taxi drivers where, you know, they have to do a test before they can drive taxis, that they know, they have what's called the knowledge. They know all the streets of London and where they are. They know how to get to places. And brain scans have shown that the parts of their brains for dealing with spatial stuff are bigger. And that presumably happens to all of us, whatever we work on. I, as a child, was rather bad at school, and I was good at practical things. And so people say, he's good with his hands, as if my hands were not directed by my brain. But that view of social status and innate intelligence, people internalize it. I mean, friends of mine who are unskilled workers believe that they are unskilled workers because they are stupid. I explain, I've had twice as many years of education as you have had. When I was small, I was taken to all sorts of things by my parents, and they had lots of books at home and so on. But that isn't really answering your question. I don't think I can say more than I said to your daughter. I do think people see through these things. I think that there is an increasing section of the population who is disgusted by consumerism and status competition and so on. When I talked about my son's friends, who their attitude to society, where did that come from? It was an intuition. I felt that one of the nicest things about retiring was feeling I would never be assessed again. Being assessed is the most demeaning thing possible, and to have to go through it again and again, as you do whenever you send a paper to a journal. You feel assessed whenever you apply for a research grant, when you apply for a job or promotion, all the time. And, you know, what you say about the importance of status in the United States, I've sat through dinner parties where people have told, the dinner party has consisted really of people telling funny stories. But each funny story has had a subtext. You know, this funny thing happened when I was going up to get my prize for such and such. Or this extraordinary thing happened when my family were coming back from their holidays in the Far East. It was at the airport in wherever. You know, different ways of showing, of communicating status. We were in Chile recently, and because the British Embassy paid for fares of people, British people going to this or speaking at a conference, they invited the people they paid for, the Brits, to dinner. And there were about half of us were Brits and the others were Chilean. And the woman ambassador asked people to introduce themselves around the table. And some said fairly short things, just, you know, I'm a professor and I work on this. And some people would go on for 5 or 10 minutes saying, and before that I chaired this and I set up such and such, and you know, going on really trying not to leave out any of the wonderful and important things they'd done. And when we talked about this sort of pattern, Kate and I, before, and when it got round to Kate, she said, I work on self-enhancement and narcissism. And some of the people laughed, but not all of them.
All right, I think it, yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for this wonderful event. Really appreciate it.